Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, celebrity baby clothes, lost and found dogs, Nick Drake fans of the world unite, and the original Tonight Show featuring Steve Allen. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. Sadorus, Illinois, located in central Champaign County, is named for the area's first European permanent resident, Henry Sadorus, who arrived in the early 1800s. Over the next century and a half, the founding family saw its legacy rise and ultimately begin to disappear. That changed in the early 1970s with the discovery of an enormous body of photographic work, 150 mounted prints and 700 glass plate negatives, found in the attic of one of the Sadorus family's former homes. The photos were the work of Henry Sadorus' great-grandson, Frank, who documented life on the family farm during the early 1900s. Frank's father, G.W.B., mother, Phoebe, and siblings Enos, Warren, Elmer, and Mary were the frequent stars of the portraits as they worked and played at their homestead. The beautiful farm and timberland were also featured as Frank Sadorus explored photography and imagery. Judith Lloyd is the curator of a traveling photo exhibit chronicling the work and history of Frank Sadorus. As part of the Illinois Humanities Council and the radio series Illinois Stories, Lloyd transports us into the short but talented life of one of Illinois' first documentary photographers.
Frank was self-taught, and he really was an amateur. I mean, he did learn a little bit from his brother, but basically he learned from books and magazines that he ordered by mail and that were brought to him by the Wabash Railroad. He photographed the farmhouse in every season. It was one of the things that he came back to over and over again in his life. The homestead was the heart of the farm. I mean, there were the lands and there were the animals and there was raising of the crops and the harvesting of them. The farm was home to him and he couldn't live without it. Almost everybody has a family album that's been pulled out of the attic. And in many cases, they're wonderful photographs, but people look awkward. They're smiling crookedly. They're looking like they'd really rather be someplace else. These people were so used to having it, so accustomed to having a camera around, that it was just part of their life. This is a big mural shot that we had blown up from the original negative, but it was impromptu theatrical production. It's called The Pumpkin Band, and there's G.W.B. is on the drums. Of course, the drum is really just a old wash tub. He's hitting it with a stick. Warren is there with his hat pushed back on his head, and he's playing the broom. Elmer looks like he's playing a trumpet of sorts, a flower pot with a stick stuck through it. His cheeks are puffed out. I mean, they really got into it. They weren't just, you know, doing it to indulge this eccentric brother and son. I mean, they were having fun.
You really get a sense of their family from this shot.
Yeah, that's the thing about this family. They really seemed to like each other. They had fun together. They seemed to be living in this sort of idyllic Eden, which is what's so hard when everything turns around later, when the family falls apart.
How would he have ever known that he was talented?
How does any artist know that you're talented? Because it was important to him, and he recognized when he looked at some of these still lives that we're standing in front of, that they were beautiful images and that they spoke to him, and I think he whether or not he thought they'd speak to somebody else, he recognized their artistic power. Well, I think this is maybe my favorite photograph in the show. He's taken a big, sort of heart-shaped, flat leaf, pinned it to a tree trunk. And then he's taken a branch of flowers with several blossoms on it and pinned it on top of the leaf. So you get this multi-layered textured effect of the softness, fragility of the blossoms against a leaf that almost looks brittle. And then that's contrasted to the very coarse tree trunk. And so you've got these wildly contrasting textures and this light that rakes across it. And just quite beautiful. The lumber industry was encroaching more and more into the timberlands around the farm. And they would find trees that had been stripped. On one of the photographs, Frank wrote on the back, it was actually one of the postcards that he made of a stripped tree, and he sent it to Enos, and it said, "I've got a grouch. Some giddy dollar chaser has chopped down three trees there and just left them where they fell, and the fourth is barked." There's a sense of forlornness that somehow seems related to the destruction of the timberlands that he loves. His father died in June of 1911, and that was the turning point in their life. The farm was sold. His mother Phoebe, his sister Mary, and his brother Elmer took their proceeds of the estate, bought a house, new house, and moved into it. Frank moved by alone. He went to a little two-room cottage, which is probably this little photograph here, a little box that he's moved into. He packed away his camera and all his equipment, and for all intents and purposes didn't photograph again. Within 3 months, his family took him to court to have him committed, and the doctor described him as troubled with delusions and hallucinations and a pronounced tendency to worry. The doctor also noted he was well-mannered with a kind disposition. At the time of his commitment, Frank was 37 years old, and he stayed at the Kankakee Mental Insane Asylum for the next 17 years of his life until he died on Christmas Day, 1934. He had free use of the grounds, and one day he just left the asylum and started walking down the railroad tracks in the direction of home. And the authorities at the asylum called the family, told them, and then they were going to go after him and bring him back, but he just stopped and turned around and walked back. I suppose he must have realized the futility of what he was doing, because the farm wasn't his anymore. He couldn't go home to the farm. There was a woman who came into the gallery when the show was up in Chicago. We were standing in front of a big, wonderful mural of Frank holding his bicycle. And he's just got such a, he's just has on his little hat, and he's looking at the camera with a kind of smile on his face. And you just really feel like he's looking at you. And this woman I was talking to said, "Yeah, I think I've kind of fallen in love with Frank." And I said, "Yeah, I think I have too." And he seems to have that effect on people, the combination of how sweet he was, how funny he was, how talented he was, and the fact that the photographs are really lovely and they capture a moment in time that one can never go back to.
This story is part of Illinois Stories, a a radio series brought to you by the Illinois Humanities Council. The series was produced and reported by Jesse Hardman. The Illinois Humanities Council is an educational, nonprofit organization that gives grants and creates programs that bring communities together with humanities scholars to actively exchange ideas. For more information, please call 312-422-5580 or visit www.prairie.org. Got attuned to Sidetrack. If you've ever had a dog, you've probably had to deal with what happens when a dog runs away and gets lost. Champagne writer Jenny Parr knows about lost and found dogs all too well.
Someone once told me, you have one perfect dog in your life, and after it's gone, you spend the rest of your life trying to find it again. I had a perfect dog once. He was a black collie named Bear. He was smart, sweet, and telepathic in his understanding of human ways, with a comic, independent soul of his own that made him charming and unpredictable. His loss after only 8 years with our family was a tragedy. After a suitable period of mourning, we decided that we had to get another dog. The empty stair landing gave me a pang whenever I went up and down without having to step around a furry-prone form, and it was a wrench to go for a walk without having something striding along with us on 4 feet, with tail waving and nose sniffing. We had enjoyed sharing life with a dog, and found it difficult to do without. I contacted the Collie Club and found a breeder near Springfield who had a litter of puppies and some older dogs. She also had a young male dog that she had been keeping, hoping to breed, but she had lately decided to sell him. We drove out to the breeder's home and looked over the clean barn, the large grassy fields in the lake. It was a dog's paradise. The collies were all healthy and sleek and balancing with glee at the sight of our two children. In particular, the young male was splendid. Long black collie fur surrounded his white ruff, which in turn circled his black face and tan muzzle. Most importantly, he had the traditional collie disposition, which he exhibited as he let our children lead him around on a leash, trotting gaily, tail high, tongue lolling. After receiving assurances from the breeder as to his health, temperament, shots, and neutered status, we agreed to buy him. The breeder gave us some snacks and the squeaking fuzzy camel that was his favorite toy. When we got him home, however, he became bewildered. He walked, hesitating, into our house and looked around in confusion and concern. What was this new place with its strange smells? Where was the kennel? Where was his bed? Where were the other dogs? What about the green pasture and barn? He drooped, he slunk, he sighed, and he would not eat. We called the breeder, who advised us that there would be an adjustment period and that he would not starve himself. She suggested that we just wait it out and he would come around. Collies are usually light-hearted, she told us, and are biologically unable to be sad around children. So we waited. The children tried to play with him, but even the squeaking camel did not make him really happy. He duly retrieved thrown toys, but he was clearly just going through the motions. He moped, nibbled at his food, and even walks with the family would not raise his spirits. He would periodically stop, gazing around, smelling the unfamiliar smells, and look mournfully at all of us. We named him Tristan, as in Tristan and Isolde, after the star-crossed medieval lovers, because he was such a tragic character. Then one day he disappeared. A visiting relative had let him out and had not put him in our fence, and he had run away. Don't worry, my husband told our stricken children. We'll get him back. The 2-week period that follows is a bit blurred in my mind. During this time, my husband and I, in addition to our full-time day jobs, began to work our new night job, finding the dog. We contacted the Humane Society and put up posters of the missing dog in likely places in Champaign, Urbana, Savoy, and Tolono. Then the calls began to come. Are you still missing that black dog? Well, I saw him today in a cornfield, the caller would say, and give a location. And off we would go with supper bowl, squeaking camel, and snacks. The callers were always kind and also encouraging. Some would offer advice, such as, lost dogs always circle around. Figure out where he has been, and you should be able to figure out where he's going. This was true. He was circling in a counterclockwise direction, as our plotting of dog sightings on our Champaign County map revealed. Others would tell stories of their lost dog successfully recovered after several days. Still others volunteered to join the hunt, and the breeder actually came out and helped us one night. In the course of our searching, we discovered that the dog preferred cornfields. In fact, he was conducting a methodical tour of them. According to the sightings, he ranged from cornfields around Rolling Acres in Champaign to the cornfields of Tolono. He must have liked the tall, jungle-thick stalks, for he was never spotted in soybeans. In the first days, the calls increased in frequency, and we got close to Tristan's whereabouts several times. One evening, I discovered tantalizingly fresh dog footprints by a stream and a place where the tall grass had been flattened into a round bed, and one day we actually saw him in a cornfield in Savoy. We had been alerted to his appearance there by a cell phone call from a man in a car. He had nearly hit the dog, which had just crossed from one cornfield to another. We raced out there and were standing at the corner of the field when the dog poked his head out 50 yards to the east of us. He took one wide-eyed look at us and fled back into the corn. This was discouraging. The sightings became less frequent as the days passed and stopped entirely after the end of the second week. I began, after 2.5 weeks, to think that there was no way the poor creature could still be alive. We had had some severe weather with lots of thunder and rain. If he were still among the living, he would have endured very nasty conditions outside, even protected by the stalks of corn. In desperation, and with the approval of the property owner in the location of his last sighting, we put out a portable kennel with a blanket, some food, and a bowl of fresh water. We hoped he was still alive and would find the kennel, which we checked twice daily. But neither the kennel nor its contents was ever disturbed. After Tristan had been missing for almost 3 weeks, my husband and I, but not our children, had given up hope. Then we got the call. A Champaign animal control officer told me that a dog fitting the description of our missing collie had been found by air traffic control on the runway of Willard Airport. It seems the dog had been dashing around, keeping the planes from taking off and landing, so the airport had called animal control and the dog had finally been caught. I remember thinking, why? Why must an animal control officer with a net catch the dog on the runway of an airport? Why couldn't he be caught by a troop of brownies on a camping trip, or by a kindly farmer about to begin harvesting, or by a friendly bicyclist who happened to have a cell phone, a spare leash, and away with dogs, or by my husband and me? In any event, the officer offered to bring the dog over so that I could identify him. It took him just a few moments to get to the house, and then he unloaded a dog from his truck, and I found myself viewing the most woe-begone creature I had ever seen. The dog was thin and scrawny and shook as he stood in the driveway. Burrs the size of ping-pong balls had lodged deep in his fur all over his body and legs. Simply lying down must have been a misery. He was panting, and standing up seemed to be a challenge. "Is this your dog?" asked the officer. I pondered the question a moment. Was this my dog? Had he ever been my dog? Did he even want to be my dog? Or did he view me as a sort of canine kidnapper who had lured him into my car and conveyed him to alien lands, far away from his friends, lake, barn, and fields? Did he think of me as an evil human fiend, determined to hunt him down and drag him from his secret hiding places to some terrible dark end? I would, of course, pay for his medical treatment, but would it be kinder to return him to the breeder thereafter? Should I even tell the kids that he had been found? But as I was thoughtfully regarding the dog, he became aware of me. He took a few steps toward me, raised his head, and looked at me. Then something seemed to flicker behind his eyes. His gaze softened, and he walked forward and licked my hand. His tail began to wag. "Yes," I said, "this is my dog." I called our family veterinarian while the dog drank water and rested in the shade of the front porch. I was a bit panicky. "Doctor, he's been living in the wild for 3 weeks, and he looks terrible with burrs everywhere, and he's horribly thin, and I'm sure he's eaten all kinds of food that's poisonous, and can I bring him right over?" Our vet, used to the hysterics of his human clients, advised me that I could indeed bring him right over, and he would be seen right away. I also thought I heard a note of triumph, a challenge at last, and maybe also of happiness. We're set for payroll, but that was perhaps my imagination. After a week with the vet, during which our children had visited the dog repeatedly, Tristan came home. He was returned to us in glorious condition. The vet and his assistants had done a heroic job. All evidence of the burrs had disappeared. His coat shined. There was spring in his step, sparkle in his eye, and best of all, he was happy. He loved his family, his squeaking camel, and his food. He loved going for walks. He loved sleeping on the landing and tripping everyone going up and down the stairs. In fact, he blossomed into a magnificent companion who was up for anything, especially things involving children. There have, however, been two lasting after-effects of Tristan's 3-week sojourn in the cornfields. First, he now has a deep, abiding fear of thunderstorms. The merest rumble from a distant cloud will send him, whimpering and panting, to my husband for comfort. "Wish I could do something about it, Tristan," says my spouse while petting him. And the second, the dog no longer has any inclination to roam from home. He has decided that we are to be preferred to the prairie wilds of Champagne, Savoy, and Tolono. He no longer turns towards the wind, gazing into the distance, no longer waffles the breeze through his fuzzy cheeks, seeking something, and no longer looks mournfully at the humans in his life. We are his people, and he is our dog. He may not be a perfect dog, and we may not be perfect people, but we belong, and we are happy together.
Jenny Parr is a lawyer and a writer who lives with her family and dog in Champaign. Still to come on the program, a fan of musician Nick Drake travels to his hometown to unite with fellow fans, and we talk to the author of Inventing Late Night, Steve Allen, and the original Tonight Show. Stay tuned. This is Sidetrack. Not only do movie stars wear clothes that stand out in a crowd, but now their children do as well. Nicole Pugh, who owns Bundles of Blossoms in Taylorville, is one of the reasons why. Nikki is mother of three and creator of Luxury Baby Goods. Jiffy Johnson talked with her recently and asked why she started the business.
It all actually evolved because my husband was working two jobs. He'd left a really stressful job, and I saw him working two jobs, and I literally didn't see him. He wasn't home. I was raising the kids alone, and his 82-year-old mother lives with us, and, you know, none of us were seeing him. It killed me, and on the weekends he'd come home, and he'd be exhausted, and I'd feel terrible, but I know I couldn't leave the kids, and I got online, and I read books about telemarketing and medical transcribing, and it was not interesting. And I've always wanted to work with luxury goods. I mean, I remember as a kid decorating my back porch at my mom's house in fine linens. I've always liked the glitz and the glam and been interested in Hollywood, but I didn't want to work outside the home.
So you decided to create, and in this case, children's clothes,
exactly.
An obvious choice,
right,
with the children that you had.
Well, at first I started making soap just to see if I wanted to even put my foot into business. I'd been at home for probably 6.5 years having babies. I didn't even know if I wanted to be in business, so I thought I'd try a little hobby of some sort, and it was the soap, and it was a lot of physical work, and it was too demanding. I couldn't do it. So I decided to design clothes, design luxury clothes. I went on the internet, and there wasn't even a market for it, and I didn't know if that was a good sign or a bad sign.
So you stepped into this niche, which was unfilled, to create clothing that was glamorous for small children.
Yes. I pretty much made them for celebrities. They're real big on non-mass produced items. I have a luxury line, and that's for celebrities primarily because the price is so high. But I also like to make mainstream boutique goods to sell to the public.
But the one-of-a-kind appeal to the stars.
Yes.
But then how did you get the okay. access? Because you're here in Taylorville.
There was a press release from my marketing company, which is what they do is they, you know, tell all the new creations that I'm designing. They put that out in the press. Well, Google picked it up, Yahoo, MSN, and a company out in New York City, the Creative Coalition, founded by Christopher Reeves, picked up on this luxury designer here in the Midwest. Well, the company working for them, who puts these gigantic galas on for the stars, started looking into my lines and invited me to be one of the top 40 designers out in Bel Air last December. And so that's where I started making a lot of connections. I started working with other vendors. We were able to exchange, you know, information, and it's been a ride. I got real friendly with a lot of celebrities out there as well. Sharon Lawrence from NYPD Blue and Desperate Housewives by far has been, we've become friends. I talk to her about every 2 weeks. I worked 2 days straight with Joe Pantoliano from The Sopranos. Rhoda from Mary Tyler Moore with Valerie Harper. Paul DeJorio from Paul Mitchell Hair Products. Gary Busey was another one. It was incredible.
What was the process of working with these stars? Was it easy, challenging?
They were a lot easier to work with than I thought. I had a couple of them, which, without mentioning names, that they portrayed the star image. But for the most part, they were very down to earth. I mean, you feel like, you know, you could welcome them into your home and sit down and have coffee at the coffee table. I mean, they were very relaxed. You would never even know they were a celebrity. At one point during that gala, we were walking around and, you know, just bumping shoulders with these people, and I never even thought about it, who they were. After so many hours, it didn't even feel like they were Hollywood movie stars in the least.
Being far from either New York or Hollywood, mm-hmm. Does that present some logistical problems for you?
You know what? Technology is great. You can get a lot done through the computer and through the telephone. The Postal Service and UPS has been phenomenal. One thing good about what I do in my website, there's so many variations of my business. A lot of people online carry my products too, who also market to celebrities. So therefore, name recognition constantly. Heidi Klum, for instance, went through another website seeking Bundles of Blossoms product lines for her baby, which at the time she thought was a girl, but ended up surprising her, and it ended up being a little boy. And she went through another website trying to find me and ended up purchasing.
If you tried this 30 years ago, it would have been difficult, but now it's easy.
I think you would have had to live either in Hollywood or New York to accomplish what I've accomplished today. There's a lot of back and forth communication. Emails are quick. Type something in, you get the question answered, they make the decision, process the order, or they don't process the order.
Do you actually design the clothes with the star's input, or do you make the item and then they see what you've got?
I design the item that I think represents them. The Britney bag that I designed exclusively for Britney Spears. I'm very familiar with Hollywood. I'm very familiar with Britney and what she likes, what her style is, what her fashion is. So what I do is when I'm laying in bed at night or just got a minute to think, I think of what I could create for that person, for who they are. And then I create and then present. And I usually capture it.
When would you pinpoint your moment of inspiration for all this?
I had a really traumatic pregnancy with my third son, and I'd ruptured. I remember the nurses telling everyone there's no pulse, and my husband crying and holding this baby. And so after that, I survived, obviously, and the baby was fine. I had to go home and recuperate for weeks. I mean, the Alter Society came in and brought meals, you know, farm women who had many babies, they knew how devastating it was. Got to watch a lot of Oprah, and I heard a lot of inspiring stories from moms to millionaires, and that was kind of the let's get on with this and let's do something, life's too short. It was just a very big awakening for me.
So you decided that you needed to take an idea and move with it.
Take an idea, and I had to be, it had to be something I was passionate about. If you don't have the passion, you cannot succeed. This business, and as much as I've loved it, has been hard. I think, okay, I'm going to give it up. Then what will I design? So the passion's there to keep moving with this.
Now, you have a boutique back here with some of the goods that you've created.
The Britney bag over here, which was made for Britney Spears, is made out of a pink bubble fur and green charmeuse satin and sequins. And it's been a bag that's really drawn people in today.
It's an over-the-top bag. Every piece of it is saying, I am here.
I am here. Look at that. You have the sequins down there on the bottom and just screams Britney, and an oversized bow that hangs over the side.
Did you make these cute little booties? Tell me about them.
These little booties, they're in small and large, and they go up to about size 2. And what they can do, you can take the top of them and unroll them, and you can make them knee boots for the little babies, you know, make them in style for a little while. I made a lot of luxury blankets out of faux minks and faux fur.
Did you make the cape?
Yeah, I made the cape. It's out of a red mink and a white bubble fur on the back.
When we say bubble fur, what we mean is it's fur that it's sort of pushes up in spots. It's like it's sort of like overgrown bubble wrap.
That's exactly what it is, and it's extremely soft. It's soft like mink. I've also met a partner with me, a girlfriend all my life. We've created a Divine Diner line. It's a bib line, and it's got 3 stages, newborn, baby, and toddler. And the toddler bib is our favorite because it comes down and it rests on the baby's lap like a cloth napkin in a restaurant. So you save the, you know, the spills and mess on the lap.
I should say these booties are camo or faux fur or all kinds of tartan plaids.
They're out of an animal fleece that, again, you just can't find anywhere, out of the leopard and the replica of the Burberry plaid, Dalmatian, zebra, Bengal tiger. They're very versatile. You can dress them up or dress them down.
And now here's a bubble fur cape that's huge with the bubble fur on the outside.
That was the biggest seller out in L.A. They're hot pink bubble fur with a black mesh on the backside. And you can trim it out with cow faux fur or leopard or giraffe, whatever you decide. We specifically made blankets and bibs for the Red Hat Society that's real big in Christian County. We wanted to target that market with it's a different kind of Red Hat fabric. It's, again, something you wouldn't find around here.
So where do you see this going?
I hope I go big time. I'm not playing. It'll be 3 years in February. I hope to have my own boutique, possibly, but I'd like to actually get bigger than that. I'd really like to start doing a lot more mass production. I'd really like to get involved more in trade shows. They're so expensive to even start that I'm not to that point yet. I'd like to get enough to acquire enough money to actually be able to go, you know, to 10, 12 shows a year and really get my lines out. But right now I'm focusing from the home while my children are small, just sending out my custom lines at this point. If people think staying at home and having a business and raising a family, I was told not too long ago, when are you going to get a job? And I remember thinking how many nights I've sat at my kitchen table hearing birds chirping and looking outside and seeing the sunlight and thinking, oh my gosh, I did it again. I'm up all night and the kids will be up in 2 hours. It's more than a job. It's a passion. It's my life.
Nicole Pugh is owner of Bundles of Blossoms in Taylorville. She was talking with Jiffy Johnson. To see more of these celebrity baby clothes, go to bundlesofblossoms.com. You're listening to Sidetrack. It goes without saying that in this, the era of the internet, you can find people all over the world who share your same interests, no matter what they are. Jeffrey Dugan is a fan of musician Nick Drake. Last summer, he and several other fans of Drake, whom Dugan met over the internet, got together in Drake's hometown in England to unite in music, fun, and friendship.
Ever wonder what it would be like to get together with people you only know from the internet? It's a little scary. It's even crazier to fly to another continent to do it. But that's just what I did this past summer. Now let me put this in perspective. I consider myself a creative person, but I'm not a weirdo. I'm kind of an average guy. But I'm a big fan of Nick Drake. Now, it's hard to connect with others here in my hometown of Baltimore who like Nick Drake. Ah, but I live in the age of the internet, and I've managed to find a small but hardy bunch of folks who have this similar interest. I went to the middle of England in a small little town called Tanworth in Arden to hook up with fellow fans of Nick Drake.
I never felt magic crazy as this. I never saw moons, knew the meaning of the sea. I never held emotion in the palm of my hand. I felt sweet breezes in the top of a tree. But now you're here, bright in my northern sky.
Now, Nick Drake isn't exactly a household name. He put out 3 albums and died in obscurity in 1974. But he had a resurgence of sorts. A couple of years ago, his song Pink Moon was used in a Volkswagen commercial.
I saw it written and I saw it say, Pink Moon is on its way.
Suddenly, interest in Nick Drake skyrocketed. Websites were set up. People were curious. Who was this guy? So many of his songs are haunting, as if they were precursors of his fate. He knew he would die in obscurity.
Fame is but a fruit tree, so very unsound. Can never flourish till its stalk is in the ground. So men of fame can never find a way till time has flown far from their dying day.
I belong to a message board. It's basically just a few fans getting together, and we sort of like each other's company. We toyed with the idea for years of actually getting together in Nick's hometown, but I never thought it would actually happen. One member, Sammy, actually set a date, and the next thing I knew, I was on a plane. The adventure was dubbed Our Merry Abandon by another board member named Caro, who came all the way from Seattle, Washington. We had a concert planned and a church service. My adventure really began the night before the concert. Now picture me, this is Friday afternoon around dusk. I've been awake for 2 days, traveling since Thursday. On very little sleep, I trudged off to this little town in England to meet some of my internet friends for the first time. I'm jet-lagged, my hair is matted to my head, and I'm sitting outside the Bell, a little country pub, nursing a Guinness, looking out for people that I had no idea what they looked like.
Strange face with your eyes, so pale and sincere, underneath. You have nothing to fear for the dream.
After a while, I noticed one guy who seemed a little out of place in the pub. It turned out to be Chris, another board member who had traveled up from Belgium for the big event. Soon afterwards, Sammy, Caro, Alan, and Mark arrived, 4 more board members, and we all had a great big dinner, learned a little bit about each other, and what to expect for the Saturday night gig. They were really nice people, and I was very glad I'd made the trip. After food, conversation, many laughs, and many more pints of Guinness, I went across the street and led the way to Nick Drake's final resting spot. Now, it was getting quite dark by this point, and fortunately Chris had brought a flashlight with him. We carefully set out to cross the darkening graveyard. The ground was uneven, and a few people did trip. Soon we all surrounded the gravesite, standing quietly as a lone beam of light illuminated the headstone. Caro had brought her guitar with her from the car. She and I peeled off from the others to a nearby bench, and quietly, Caro began to play the familiar chords from a Nick Drake tune, and began to softly sing in the dark.
Voice from the mountain and voice from the sea. Voice in my neighborhood is calling me.
And at that very moment, I knew I'd made this trip at the right time.
When can it end? It end this voice from above.
I could have come here by myself, but there are a few words to describe just how I felt at that moment. I knew I was experiencing a little bit of strange and simple magic. After the song, the others beckoned us to the far end of the graveyard and a small wooden gate. Outside the gate, we found ourselves in a meadow, far from the town and the rest of the world. We were high above the surrounding countryside, and I felt like I could see forever over the fading horizon. The night was warm, the air was crisp and fresh, and the heavens above were only slightly overcast. Oddly, there was just one single star in this northern sky, and it was directly overhead. One by one, Caro, Alan, and Mark took turns playing songs as Sammy, Chris, and I sang along, clapped, and soaked up the scene. It reminded me of some of the fondest memories of my youth, when friends would gather and songs would be played and everyone sang and dreamed and our troubles were either far away or non-existent. Eventually, we parted with plans to regroup the following evening for the big concert. As my cab sped off into the night back toward my hotel, I knew that I had just experienced a rare treat indeed. The concert the next night would be a lot of fun. People would show up from all over the world. But for me, that spontaneous jam in the meadow, a stone's throw from Nick Drake's grave, that was the highlight of my summer vacation. Now's the time for the curse.
That story from independent producer Jeffrey Dugan. This is Sidetrack. Everything we know about late-night talk shows, the monologue, the desk, the stunts, and the band, basically came from Steve Allen. That is, according to a new book called Inventing Late Night, Steve Allen and the Original Tonight Show by Ben Alba. It's published by Prometheus Books. I talked with Alba recently and asked him how The Tonight Show with Steve Allen came to be.
It really was more of an evolution from his days in early radio into early television. And it wasn't so much that he sat down and decided, well, I think I'm going to have a desk here, and I'm going to go out into the audience there and then have these celebrity guests and all that. But it was just different elements that came about. And just to give an example, work that he was doing in radio was pretty much what everybody else was doing at the time in the 1940s, which was heavily scripted, very tightly scripted programs, and he'd be slavishly writing everything he was going to say on the air the night before. And he wanted to take the lazy way out, he admitted later on, and he thought that maybe if he could start interviewing people, interviewing celebrities in particular, that that might be a better way out. And in fact, it was a lot less work for him to do, he discovered. And that went pretty well, and he started having audiences come in to the shows that he was doing and start watching him. And this was really something that he didn't really devise as much as people wanted to drop in, and he just started letting more and more people come by. And one night, the celebrity interview format was working pretty well until the one night that Doris Day, who was the scheduled guest because of a mix-up, didn't show up. And he found himself with 20 minutes of air to fill and what to do. I mean, he played both sides of her record, and he was wondering, well, maybe I could take this clunky floor mic, and you know, this really heavy thing with an iron stand and all, and bring it into the audience and maybe interview all of you nice people here. And so he found out, rather by happenstance, that a nice little exchange with somebody in the audience, maybe with a little bit of wit, would generate a far bigger laugh than the best scripted line with Bob Hope. So then he ended up getting a local late-night show in New York City on WNBT, which was the predecessor station to WNBC. And it was a show that had evolved mainly out of his Hollywood radio show. So it had an opening monologue, and it had Steve sitting instead of at a table where he did in the studio. Now they gave him a desk, and he would interview celebrities. He would go out into the audience, interview people there, take the cameras out onto the street, engage in some wild stunts and comedy sketches. And that was the show that one of the NBC network bosses, Pat Weaver, had been watching at some point around 1953, and this is at a time where Weaver was trying to convince his bosses that there would be some revenue potential in opening up late night for network television.
One of the amazing things that you bring out in the book is, well, one, the evolution from the radio show to his New York show to the network show. You know, all along the way, it was primarily Steve Allen doing everything with a very small supporting production cast.
He had no writers on the local late night show, and the station manager thought that was great because it's a lot cheaper. So they thought that was a great economic boost for them. And then even the first, the initial stages of The Tonight Show, when Steve went on the full network, only had one writer and at most had only about three. So most of these programs were focusing or centered largely around Steve Allen's ad-lib ability.
That's one thing that really comes across in the book, is his mastery of living in the moment and knowing precisely how to react and what to say.
And it wasn't so much that he was working at it, but it was just that because he loved spontaneity, he almost prayed for things to go wrong. Because whenever anything would go wrong, it would challenge his creativity and probably spark something within him that could take it one level higher. And if anything, Tom Poston, one of the comic actors that I interviewed for the book, was fond of emphasizing that if everything went according to the script, Steve Allen would get bored. Not that he wanted you to turn the script upside down, but if there was a little bit of a variation or something that was just not quite exactly the way it was supposed to go, he would be just as much a reactor or somebody in the audience as much as he would be an actor.
On a typical night, if you tuned in to The Tonight Show, what sort of things would you see? You mentioned his ad-libbing. You know, we talked about how, you know, he would go into the audience, open up the back doors. What other sorts of things would you see from him?
Well, he'd be entertaining exotic animals that would come on the show. Sometimes it might be an elephant or a tarantula. He had a show, actually, that predated Tonight that had as a regular a live llama Can you imagine that? They were really looking for talent then. Took the cameras outside the studio, do stunts, have fun with newspapers. He'd have a fake mind-reading character on the show, that he would play himself. Some of the more strange guests, he had one, just to give a couple of examples, when he would take the show on the road to such cities as Miami Beach, and The Tonight Show was one of the first shows to go on the road, one of the guests that he would have was a lady named Mrs. Diehl, D-I-E-H-L, and her laughing parrots. And these parrots that she would bring along with her just had this knack for laughing on far longer than you ever wanted them to. They were probably about the most annoying laughing parrots you could have, and it was wild. It was just really wild to have them on. And then he had a guy named Joe Interleggi, who appeared rather frequently, and he had a knack for being able to do all kinds of unusual things, like pulling trucks using his ears and eating wood and balancing very hefty-sized human beings using his teeth. It was just one of these novelty kinds of people, very unusual, that everybody would be curious to see what they could do.
So sometimes the stars of his show weren't the Hollywood stars. They were just ordinary people.
Yeah, and in fact, that's where he found that you could really mine the audience for found humor, or you could be able to go outside up and down the street and there's found humor. I think that maybe people are able to identify that. In fact, one of the writers that I interviewed, Stan Burns, said that if he had a good line, let's say if Steve Allen had a good comedic exchange with, say, Henry Fonda, in Stan's words, that was normal. You'd expect that because Henry Fonda, even though he was a serious actor, could probably do comedy reasonably well because he was a trained professional. But when you can get ordinary people on there and have fun with them, and have fun with them not at their expense, but have fun with them, and that was a rare trait that a number of people have identified with Steve, that you could gain tremendous success. Not only would viewers like the show, but the people in the audience would feel more relaxed because they knew Steve wasn't going to take advantage of them, but he was treating them all with a great deal of respect, but yet finding a lot of humor that was within them.
In 1956, Steve Allen started also doing a Sunday night comedy variety show while still keeping his duties on The Tonight Show.
Talk about multitasking.
Wow. That must have been an amazing amount of work for Allen to do.
I don't think he thought at the beginning that it was going to be that much work. And the reason is that when he was doing The Tonight Show, he found that doing a show where it's mostly ad-lib and spontaneity, it wasn't that difficult for him to do. It came very naturally for him, even though this is five nights a week at 90 minutes. And with regard to writing that show, it would be maybe about 10% written and 90% ad-libbed. When he accepted this offer of NBC to front a Sunday night comedy hour, and this was supposed to go on opposite Ed Sullivan because NBC was desperate for some real competition for Ed Sullivan, who literally owned Sunday nights, they tapped Steve Allen, and that's when Steve discovered that the writing proportions and the amount of work was actually the opposite of doing a spontaneous late-night show, where almost 90% of the Steve Allen primetime show was going to have to be written and rehearsed and scripted very tightly, and then the other 10% could be ad-libbed, so that, if anything, it required probably a lot more work to do this one-hour comedy show than it would just to be able to breeze through The Tonight Show, as well as Steve Allen did it. And so he cut back his Tonight duties to three nights a week and kept the primetime show, but then even with that, it proved too much. So after he did the primetime show for about 6 or 7 months, he decided to leave Tonight and focus on primetime because at the time, late-night television was still new territory, and they didn't think that they were going to attract that many more than, let's say, 3 to 5 million viewers on a good night for late night, whereas with network primetime, you'd be talking between 30 and 40 million. So it made a lot of sense for Steve to move into that arena. And I think that's how he became really well-known and established around the country when everybody was able to see him earlier on Sunday nights.
Now, I of course, was way too young to see Steve Allen doing any of his shows. Are there any recordings out there of his Tonight Show, of his prime time show? Is there any way you can go back and see this, what he did?
Yeah, well, you know, there, unfortunately, with regard to the Tonight Show, almost all of the video evidence of that program does not exist any longer. These kinescopes were made during a time when there wasn't much archival value to these early shows. That was the mentality at the time, if you could believe that. Even if you had people like, let's say, Jackie Robinson or Lena Horne or Richard Rodgers or Carl Sandburg or Eleanor Roosevelt on your shows, television was a much more disposable era, and it was like the newspaper. They treated it like that. You'd read it, and then you'd pitch it. It wasn't until maybe getting into the earlier and maybe mid-1960s where they began to recognize more of a permanent value, that there was really something worth preserving in television, because Steve Allen's shows were not the only ones that were disposed of. I mean, almost all of Milton Berle's old shows, much of Jack Parr, and even most of the first 10 years of Johnny Carson. A lot of those early Carson shows were just taped over, if you could believe that. And they didn't really begin preserving them until the early 1970s. So it's just unfortunate. However, there are some shows of Steve Allen's primetime series, quite a number of those. In fact, most of them still exist. And from time to time, they get trotted out onto a cable network. And I think the last time they did that was in the early 90s on the, it was the Ha Comedy Channel, which is the predecessor to Comedy Central. And Steve actually videotaped all of the introductions and wraparounds brand new in the early 90s. And they came up with like a collection of half-hour compilations of the best of what Steve Allen had done.
That was Ben Alba, author of Inventing Late Night, Steve Allen and the Original Tonight Show. It's published by Prometheus Books. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to WILL.UIUC.edu, click Listen, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.